And he's funny. Time for the show.
Sometimes faith can feel as cold as winter, and it can look as dark as winter, too. I grew up in the cold in Wisconsin, so I understand being physically cold. But I also understand being spiritually cold, feeling distant from God because of depression, because of sickness, because of friends dying. I feel distance from God often, and I used to fight those feelings, but now I embrace them, and I sit with them. Winter Faith has become my new home. So I created the Winter Faith podcast, because sometimes faith feels like winter. All right, welcome to the show today. I know it's been a while since I've done an episode, and I'm really excited to be back doing an episode, and today is a pretty good episode. I have Brian McLaren, who is an author, speaker, activist, and just overall good guy. Public theologian is what his post says. But he just wrote a couple of books I'm really interested. One of them was Faith After Doubt, which kind of looks at the different stages of faith, which I reference in the podcast. And also Do I Stay Christian, which is an excellent book, Do I Stay Christian. It came out just 2 months ago. And what he talks about in that book is really interesting to me because he discusses reasons why you should say, no, I'm done being a Christian, and this is why, because of genocide, because of the patriarchy, because of the various problems and issues that Christianity has. Or he says yes, and yes could be because of Jesus, the founder of our faith. Or maybe he says yes because he wants to be part of the solution, not part of the problem. And so he really gives very, really good reasons, yes or no, to stay Christian. I like that he gives both sides. So I talk about both those things in this podcast. We also, Brian and I, discuss just my health, my podcast. We talk about suffering. He shares stories from his life of suffering that are really impactful. And so I was really excited to talk with Brian McLaren, and I hope you enjoy this episode as much as I did for recording it. And thank you so much for tuning in to the Winter Faith Podcast. Let's get into it. I've never had my health messed with ever. And which I mean, most people in their 30s that they haven't.
Yeah.
I think the other thing is, like, I don't look any really different. I've lost some weight. So people think, like, oh, you must be really healthy. Because I think our only judge is, like, weight sometimes.
Yes, you're right.
Like, we don't, I mean, I guess, like, if, you know, if I didn't have any hair, they'd be like, okay, your cancer must be bad.
Yes.
But most people are like, oh, you look really good because you've lost weight. But it's like, yeah, but I didn't lose weight a good
way. Want to. Yes.
So that has been it's been a real challenge. I was a hospital chaplain after seminary, and that was, you know, extremely humbling. And so I thought I had a good perspective before of kind of suffering and you know, learning about your faith through suffering. I've always been interested in, like, the Book of Job since I was a kid. And now I feel like, okay, I did the hospital chaplaincy. I worked as a chaplain, but now I've been the person in the bed.
Yes.
And that adds a whole another dynamic.
Oh,
so it's really interesting, like, doing this podcast, and some people are like, well, you asked for it. Like, you, you named your podcast Winter Faith, and now you've experienced, I think I've always experienced a level of it. But and there's some other people that write about it. And I think even in your own writing, I've got the book on display, but Faith After Doubt, you know, I know it's not your most recent book, but you talk about kind of like the stages of faith. And I think, oh, my whole idea of, like, winter faith fits in pretty nicely, because you could, you know, people like Richard Rohr or Brueggemann, or you yourself, like, have these different levels. I know other people do, of, like, you know, what is Brueggemann's, like, orientation, disorientation, reorientation. Yes. Yes. And like, I feel like that's kind of what I'm thinking a little bit. Like, we have seasons of yes. faith, like summer, spring, fall. But
yes.
I also feel like some people just like, for me, I just feel like I'm always in winter, and I don't think of it as in a bad way. It's actually yes. like comforting. Like yes. I grew up in Wisconsin. I understand the cold and I like it. Like today it's like 100 degrees in North Carolina, and it's like, I would rather it be cold, but so it kind of fits in nicely with who I am yes. as well. So,
well, my heart is with you, and thanks for catching me up on that. I didn't mean to derail the direction of the conversation.
No, it's fine. A lot of people have, you know, my podcast is kind of a small but faithful group, and people follow me quite a bit with my health issues. So it's not anything new for me to talk about it on here.
Great.
But yeah, so I know that my introduction to you was reading a book in college called More Ready Than You Realize.
Oh, great.
And I really, I remember reading that book. I don't think I've ever read anything by you up to that point, even though I knew your name. But that book was, I thought, pretty optimistic, if I remember right. It's been a little bit about this idea of like, hey, people want to engage in your faith, I think, if you can live it out and practice it in a way that shows integrity, and people want to kind of hear a good story and understand you as a person. And so that was kind of my introduction to you. And then the last two books I've really resonated with because of my own health issues, but also because your most recent one, Do I Stay Christian? Like, this has been the question for, I'm 36 years old. This has been the question for so many people in my life that grew up mostly evangelical, some Catholic, some Lutheran.
Yes.
And that, like, that is the question. And your book, I think, is very helpful because you just, here's a list of reasons why the answer is no. Here's a list, and here's some reasons yes. And in my mind, I kind of have like my top two, my top three. But I just want to ask you about that most recent book, and just, yeah, let you dive in. I've been talking a lot, so. But
that's great. That's great. Well, let me say, since I wrote More Ready Than You Realize,
mm-hmm.
Which would have been right around, I think, 2002, maybe. It was mm-hmm. one of my earliest books.
Yes. Yep.
I mean, the major public forms of the Christian faith have just humiliated themselves and decomposed. I mean, you think of the huge Catholic Church scandal, you think of evangelical mega churches, you think of the whole phenomenon of white evangelicals lining up behind Trump, and then where that's led with this resurgence of white Christian nationalism. And really, I just was reading the other day about certain religious groups that are boldly claiming the term Christo-fascist, like they think that's a good thing. So you just see this sort of decomposition in many sectors of Christianity, even Eastern Orthodoxy, with the invasion of Ukraine and watching one of the leaders of the Russian Orthodox Church just line up totally behind Vladimir Putin, so that his own priests had to differentiate themselves, which is very unusual in Eastern Orthodoxy, right? So you put all that together, and things feel very different about what it means to hold Christian identity. It's getting more complicated because of these historical shifts.
And when you think about, I think, like, identity, it's kind of like we're always been searching for our own, I think, yeah. Christian identity, whether we align with certain political views to find our identity, or certain theological views, like talking about, you know, baptism, you know, what worship style we have, just thinking about different things of how we identify as Christian.
Yes.
And I think one of the things that was most helpful to me about the question, like, do I stay Christian, that resonated for me kind of like of a yes, I stay Christian, is because of you talk about it, because of our leader, because of our phenomenal yes. leader talking about Jesus.
Yeah.
And for me, I think when, you know, without reading anything, like if I had to answer that question, that's for me the big reason. But how come, you know, for some people that's like not enough, yeah. almost like, or yes, Jesus, but still the other no's of nationalism yeah. or like outweigh Jesus almost.
Yeah. 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 You know, I was just talking to somebody about this earlier today, and she said all of her adult life, well, even she said, you know, when she was a child, she wasn't sure she wanted to be part of the church. And for her, the church meant outwardly identifying with Christianity. Mm-hmm. But she said, if whenever she thought about dropping out of church, she never thought that would mean she doesn't love Jesus anymore and think Jesus is wonderful and want to live her life that way. But I actually think we're getting to the point now, and I don't want to overstate this, because what I'm about to say is not true for millions of people, but it is true for growing numbers of people, that one of the reasons they feel they need to disassociate from Christianity is because it feels so anti-Christ. It feels so anti everything Jesus was for.
Yeah.
So Jesus is for standing with the underdog, and they see Christianity trying to scapegoat trans children and their families, you know, or LGBT people. Mm-hmm. Jesus is for a view of God that is merciful and forgiving, and they see the Christian religion being, you know, unmerciful. In fact, merciless in many cases. Jesus being willing to suffer and die for the well-being of others, and they see Christianity being willing to kill and harm for their own well-being. So they see enough of that, and they just say, "Gosh." To the degree I'm bought in on Jesus and his ethic and his example and his teaching, I feel I'm at odds with this religious community. So I think mm-hmm. that can be true, and the opposite can be true, you know, at the same time for different people.
Yeah. And I think if I think about my understanding of Jesus and like the way I grew up, like with my small church in Wisconsin, I always thought Jesus did identify with the underdog. And if Jesus, or the outcast in society, like if Jesus really in the first century was seeking the ways that I see some Christian communities behave today, it's like Jesus would have been trying to start a war, like a cultural war yes. against Rome.
Yes.
And like trying to change the laws of the Roman government.
Yes.
I don't know how they would do that, because it wasn't a democracy, but I'm yes. just saying, like, it feels really odd to me to look at Jesus, like spending his time trying to change a law. And I'm not saying laws aren't like important, but like, is there a way that we can get so caught up in, and I think either side of the yes, political yes, realm yes, can yes. do this, where we're so caught up in this law needs to change.
Yes. Yeah. And this is where, just as you say, the idea, you know, Jesus did not live in a democracy. So right. it's very hard to look to him for examples of, of behavior yeah. of social and cultural change in a democracy. And this is one of the reasons why I think the Bible as a library is just so fascinating. Mm-hmm. And it's dealing with so many of these issues on so many different levels. I think, for example, of this story, the really weird and wild story of Esther in the Hebrew scriptures. And in a sense, that is a book about changing a law, because a law gets passed that's going to commit genocide against the Jewish people. And suddenly you realize you better have somebody who tries to change this law or right. all of our people are going to die. So yeah, but I think this is, and if we were to take this problem and try to turn it into a wish, here's what I think the wish is. People are saying, I wish the Christian religion gave me a feeling it was more centered on Jesus. Mm-hmm. I wish the Christian religion was actually interested in helping me learn how to love God with all my heart, soul, mind, and strength, and my neighbor as myself. I wish the Christian religion was helping me see the world as God's sacred creation. And in some places it is, and thanks be to God for that. But in a lot of places it isn't, which mm-hmm. ends up intensifying this unfulfilled wish. In fact, it's not just that it's unfulfilled, it's trampled underfoot in many cases. And I think this is part of what drives a lot of people to just say, yeah, I'm not going to live. I have 70 years to live. I don't want to waste a lot of time and effort on something that seems like it's going in the wrong direction. Now, I'm not justifying that or recommending that, but I do want to try to understand it and feel it.
Yeah. And, you know, for those that are my age, which like most of my listeners are like in their 30s and 40s, it's somebody who's maybe has grown up in church and now yeah. is starting to see and ask questions that maybe they've always had, but now they're amplified, either because like they stopped going to church because of COVID. And then it's kind of like,
yes,
well, okay. I don't need this as much as I thought. Or because of like some, you know, personal tragedy, whether it's going through a really ugly divorce or going through the loss of a young child, infertility, you know, cancer. And so when we have these big questions, and things really don't go our way,
yes,
and we're told, hey, if you follow God, everything will be okay. Everything will work out, even though scripture doesn't really seem to support that. But anyways, yes. that's what we hear in a lot of churches. And I'm not saying like the health and wealth gospel of like, if you do this, you'll get money. I didn't grow up hearing that, but yeah. I did grow up kind of, I think, with a naive understanding of how difficult life can really be. And then not yes. being able to ask questions. Like I was at a church yes. where I was encouraged to ask questions, but for those that were at churches and in communities that were never, they were just given all these answers. How do you kind of take questions and conversations like that?
You know, I was a pastor for 24 years and I had this experience that just repeated itself again and again, starting in about 1990, when our little congregation, a lot of folks started coming in who were not regular church going people. You know, I lived in Maryland, which is a predominantly Catholic state. So, mm-hmm. You know, you had a lot of people who'd been baptized as babies in Catholicism and then hadn't been back to church ever, or maybe they went through confirmation and then that was it. One of the common things I'd hear somebody say is, wow, this is pretty good. I haven't been to church in 20 years, you know? And they would make an appointment to come see me and they bring all of their toughest questions. Like, and the conversation would go something like this. I come every Sunday. I'm really touched. I'm really moved, but don't Christians believe this? And so I would feel an obligation to try to defend that belief that Christians were supposed to believe. And what I jokingly said is that they would often leave with my best answers and I would be left with their best questions. Yeah. And what I realized is I think that there are many elements of traditional Christian faith that have to be rethought. And all that means is we have to give Christianity permission to be a growing religion, that Christianity didn't get its best answers in 1954 or 1820 or 1515 or 3315, that Christianity is in a constant, like any other community. It's in the process of learning. And in fact, this is where in my writings, I like to use science as an example. Science earns our trust because it is willing to change its facts based on new evidence. It doesn't throw out evidence and hold on to what it used to say. It is willing to change and grow. And we need something similar. And so when you mention the issue of suffering, suffering, you know, I've had my share in my own life. And of course, as a pastor, I was inundated with the sufferings of others on scales that I had never experienced. And I had been taught that the definition of God is a supreme being who is in control. And so when people were suffering, their job was to discern how it was God's will for them to be suffering. So it was this sort of God above the universe who sets it in motion and controls it. And I remember thinking some years into ministry, whatever God is, I don't think that's it. Right. I don't think that's a helpful way to think about God. I have to keep defending it, but it's making less and less sense to me. And it's funny, I haven't thought of this in years, but I was preaching on a psalm. Now I can't even remember which psalm it was. And as I was preparing my sermon, the psalm says something like this: do not be like a horse or mule that require a bit and bridle to keep them in check. So the picture is, you know, you're a horseback rider and you've got to control them. What the psalmist was saying is, that's not the relationship God wants with you. God doesn't want a relationship of control with you. And I thought, yeah, what if that understanding that that God's desired relationship is a relationship of control, what if God's not like that? God desires a relationship that's not a relationship of control. It's a relationship. And you see it, for example, in the fourth gospel in the New Testament, when toward the end, Jesus says, I no longer call you servants. I call you friends, as if to say, my real goal isn't just having you do what I tell you. I want us to be in this together. All of that starts to make me think, and as you know, in the book, it's one of the things I was very happy I got to write about in this book, Do I Stay Christian, is that I think we're at this really epical moment in Christian history when we have to do some very deep rethinking about what we mean when we say the word God. And after we do that, what kind of relationship does God actually even desire with the universe?
And I really liked the format of the book. And one of the things that, I mean, I almost thought it was like it almost sounds like a stand-up bit, but the first sentence of the book is, nobody is born a religious jerk. It takes religion to help someone become that way. Unfortunately, I know this from personal experience. And I just liked that because it's clever, but I think it's just saying, like other people say, nobody's on an island. Nobody's born with no influence. Like, we all start somewhere and we are all a product of the environment around us in some way. And we need to remember that, like, nobody's born a religious jerk. I think that's a great thing that I need to hear sometimes, because I can look around and be like, man, there's a lot of religious jerks out there, you know? And I'm sure people have thought that about me at some point in my life, you know, like, Jesus talks about that quite a bit too.
And wouldn't you agree, Andrew, that this is part of what adulthood is about. This is part of what growing up is about. It's realizing I inherited all this stuff. I inherited a religion that told me all these things. it's my job as an adult to sift through that and decide, what of this do I want to pass on to my children?
Right.
I think every responsible parent says, I'm not going to pass that on. I'm going to pass this on instead. So in that sense, to be an adult is to take responsibility for what we're passing on. And I have a feeling that this is part of the challenge for the Christian religion, that we have to, in a sense, own our adulthood to say, just because something was given to us doesn't mean it was the best and only way to say it or think it.
And one of the chapters, I mean, I want people to read the, you know, to buy and read the book, but you've kind of touched on this, but the idea that Christianity is changing, like, currently. Yes. Yes. And so, you know, for some people, the suffering is so great, they're done with religion. Yes. for the time being. But for somebody like myself, who's had some suffering for sure. Yes. And seen suffering for sure. And is still like, but I still think this is, I still believe. It's almost like I've had periods of my life where I acted in a way that I didn't believe, and something in me, I still believed. I don't know if that makes sense, but it's like all my actions were, you know, just, I don't know. Like, I was kind of like living a non-Christian life, and like, I'm just going to do this, but I couldn't shake my belief system. I still felt like, oh, I'm not really comfortable with stuff I'm doing. And so where Christianity is right now, like, I can be a part of the change, or I am a part of the changing Christianity, wherever it goes, better or worse, like, I'm a part of it. And so we have these great thinkers, and you name a bunch of authors and ministers, and like, you're giving up on those people if you're leaving the faith. I thought that was really interesting.
I'm glad that made sense, because that is really important. I especially think it's important for white guys like us, because, you know, so many of the really dynamic breakthroughs that are happening in the Christian faith are coming from women theologians who were never given a voice, you know, for so much of our history, and from, you know, Black and Brown and Indigenous and other theologians who were always put, they were receiving the wisdom from the missionaries rather than having anything to say themselves. So I'm glad that thought, you know, made sense to you. As you were just saying that a minute ago, it brought back a memory, since suffering has been kind of a theme. When my wife and I were in our 20s, we had four children in 6 years, and our third child, at the age of six and a half, was diagnosed with cancer. And, thanks be to God, he, you know, came through, but we had 3.5 years of daily chemotherapy, and it was, you know, it's, as you know, it's cancer's no picnic. And, and I was a preacher, and I needed to give a sermon about what we were going through. I needed to talk to my congregation about it. And I made what was, for me, I mean, now this doesn't seem so bold, but it was a very bold decision for me at the time. I entitled the sermon, Making Meaning in the Madness. And because here's what I actually experienced. You know, it made me think of this when you just said, you know, there were times I just found out there was something really there inside of me. Watching my son go through what he went through, and then also just being in the cancer ward constantly and meeting so many other people and seeing so many children die and watching so many parents have to face the loss of their children. Any kind of statement like God does everything for a reason, you know, or God is doing this to teach you something, it was utterly unacceptable. It was, it was an act of cruelty to have people say that sort of thing. And, but here's the thing, I didn't feel like God made this happen to teach me a lesson. But here's what I did feel. I feel like whatever God, I felt that whatever God is, God was with us, that we had the comfort we needed. We had that our tears and our fears and our fatigue didn't go unnoticed, and that we felt a presence accompanying us, you know, that I honestly felt. But so what that allowed me to do is to say, I'm not giving up on God. God hasn't failed me. God is actually giving us strength. And not only that, we felt that God was showing up in other people, you know, who just were such a huge support to us. But that old ideas about God were no longer, they just wouldn't help us. They didn't work in that setting.
Yeah. And I think the biggest thing, like, there are moments for all of us where we want answers. Like, I want to know the answer to this question, but how often the people in my life that mean the most to me aren't because they give me the right answers. It's just because they're available.
Yes.
Because they're there.
Yes.
And as a hospital chaplain, like, I learned it's about availability. Like, if somebody pages me and I don't show up,
yes,
that's a problem.
Yes.
If I show up and say a bunch of things that aren't that helpful, it's, I mean, it's honestly not the worst thing in the world. Like, there could be better things.
Yes.
I could say wiser things, but, like, that's part of what we learned as a student. Like, when you get your first call, when you have your, like, I have no idea what I said. And the truth is, most of the time, people I talk to don't remember my name, have no idea what I said.
Yes.
They just remember if I was there or not.
Yes. Yes.
And what if we started looking at God that way?
Yes. Yes.
Like, I just want a God who's there. And I think it's hard because there's other complications of, like, well, if he's there, I want him to do something. Like, I get that, but I wonder if, I don't know, you start to go through some things in life and you kind of just want people there.
I think there's a lot of truth to that. And you know, obviously you put any of us in enough pain and we wish we had a magic wand to fix everything.
Sure. But
once and that's where those stages of grief, you know, of denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance, and meaning, where those stages of grief in some ways are what we all go through when life doesn't meet our wishes and expectations. Mm-hmm. And when you were speaking, Andrew, about wanting answers, what I feel now is if I could go back in time and to watch some of the questions I was struggling with, what I'd want to say to myself is, Brian, you can't get an answer to that question because that question has 23 assumptions that you're in the process of finding out are not valid.
Mm.
But you're in so much pain right now. If I were to tell you, you not only have a problem, you also have 23 bad assumptions. You're not ready for that. So all I can do is be here with you. You know, it's just what you said about the presence.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's what we often need is not answers. What we need is a presence that that gives us something that an answer couldn't give us. Yeah.
So for people that are kind of, I guess the hot word that I see a lot is deconstruction. For people that are deconstructing their faith, I feel like the question, do I stay Christian, is really relevant. And your book is really relevant. What other resources do you think are out there that, you know, for people that are kind of deconstructing their faith?
Well, actually, I think one of the most important is podcasts like this one. I jokingly say this, but in a way I'm not joking, that, you know, Protestants always talk about Martin Luther nailing his 95 theses to the wall.
Yeah.
I think if he were around today, he would have a podcast. and because here's the thing, a lot of our religious communities create environments where we can't ask our questions honestly, or we can ask them, but then we're required to accept the answer we're given. And if we don't, it puts us out of sync with either the leader of the group or the members of the group. And we find out that we lose all the benefits of being part of the group if we don't go along with the answers we're given. And then we think, well, gosh, maybe I need to find a new church. But then you think, I'm just going to go someplace else where I'm going to encounter the same social dynamics. And I think what a podcast offers is it offers a chance for people to listen to other people having a conversation and grappling with questions that they're not allowed to ask back where they're from.
Yeah.
And the fact that it's anonymous, it's a low risk place to mm-hmm. let your mind be exposed to some new ideas. And I just think it's incredibly valuable. Yeah.
Yeah. And you have, you know, people, I know one of the first podcasts I listened to was Trip Fuller.
Yes.
Homebrewed Christianity. That was probably like 2010. He's been at it. Man, he's been doing it a long time.
But then
there's even people that are pretty well known in the Christian circles, at least, like Rob Bell, who, you know, I think his podcast is pretty influential. And he's a person who had like this mega church. Yes. And now he kind of has a mega church podcast and he's able to reach people that I don't think would ever show up at his church.
And he, because he doesn't need a building, he doesn't mm-hmm. have to worry about taking an offering. In other words, it just creates all kinds of freedom for everybody. So in terms of resources, I think that's a big resource. I think there are also other kinds of resources that are springing up. I think about a lot of friends of mine who are pastors, and they do what they do in church on Sunday, but they might start something called a pub theology group, where it's announced that there's a gathering at a bar or some other place where there's no assumption that you agree. There's no, this is a place where you can ask anything and anything can be talked about. And so there are people creating these needed spaces. And then, you know, I do some teaching with the Center for Action and Contemplation. It's another place that creates a space for people to explore some alternative ways of seeing things.
Could you talk about that a little bit and just kind of your role there and what it is? Because I don't think a lot of people know what that is.
So there was a Franciscan friar and priest named Richard Rohr, who has been grappling with these kinds of questions for many years. He's 79 now. And about 20 years ago, Richard and I met and became friends a little more than 20 years ago, I guess. And we would bump into each other. We would be speaking at the same event and we would get a meal. And once Richard said to me, "I'm starting to realize, Brian, that we're trying to give people new theological ideas, but what they really need is a new theological way of thinking, because the new ideas can't fit in the old way of thinking." And so and as soon as he said it, I thought, you're right, that what we really help people with is not to give them new ideas, but to give them a new way of thinking. And so the way of thinking a lot of people are equipped with is yes, no, right, wrong, in, out, safe, dangerous, dualistic thinking.
Right.
That's acceptable. That's unacceptable. And psychologists call it confirmation bias. It matches what I already think or it doesn't. And everything's about accepting or rejecting. But there's another way of thinking that involves asking questions, having curiosity. I wonder why someone would say that. I wonder what they get out of a different answer than I have. I wonder what I get out of the answer I have. And it is a way of thinking that actually allows you to go beyond what you already think. And so the Center for Action and Contemplation was established to help spread that kind of thinking and figure out how that translates into action we need in the world. So it's been going for many years, and probably the thing the center is most well known for is daily meditation. They send out a little reading every day, usually from Richard's writings, but sometimes from mine and other people's. And it just sort of gives people a little thought for the day and something to think about during the day. And then they have events and something called the Living School, which is where I do some teaching, where students can take a 2-year course of study to help them think differently and explore. Yeah, exactly the kind of things we're talking about.
Okay. Yeah. And so it's, I didn't realize that. So the school is a 2-year training. Is that online? Is it virtual? Yeah. Is it in person?
So it's a combination. Most of the learning is online. And then you might, there's the center is out in Albuquerque, and you, in the course of the 2-year program, you might come out to Albuquerque 2 or 3 times for some in-person events. But what's sort of interesting, they developed this idea of online circle groups where you're doing some reading, and then you're with a group of 10 students and you talk about what you're reading and how it's affecting you. And it's a wonderful thing. But what's so interesting is that was unusual before COVID, but now everybody is used to online conversation groups. So it really is a beautiful thing.
Yeah. And I think I get the daily meditations, and then they've done several podcasts. I know that Richard Rohr has one or two podcasts.
Yep.
And then you did one.
Yes.
And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that and just kind of plug that, because I thought it was really, really good and really interesting.
Well, thanks. Yeah. So Center for Action Contemplation has a number of different podcasts that they help produce. And Richard has one that actually he's completed now. So I think there are 3 or 4 seasons. Jim Finley, who's just an amazing human being. He has one called Turning to the Mystics that is just beautiful. Barbara Holmes has a great podcast called The Cosmic We. She's a gifted African-American theologian, womanist theologian. And I do one called Learning How to See. And in fact, our 3rd season is just underway right now. And so we do 6 to 8 episodes per season and do 2 seasons a year.
Okay. And the Learning to See, what is the upcoming season kind of going to look at?
Actually, this season is really related to this book, Do I Stay Christian? So it's called Learning How to See Christianity. And so the 2 most recent episodes, I'm so happy that I got to do these. I wanted to help people see Christianity, but I wanted to help Christians see Christianity the way non-Christians see it, what people of other religions see it. And so previous episode, a friend of mine who's a rabbi, Rabbi Jill Jacobs, she came on and talked about Christianity's history of anti-Semitism and how that affects Jews, and how it was just a beautiful, informative conversation. And then the most recent, my dear friend, Valerie Kaur, who's a member of the Sikh religion, people often say Sikh religion, she just shares some really heart touching stories of what it was like to grow up a brown Sikh girl in California, where everyone around her was a white Christian, and just really beautiful stories to help Christians see how our religion can have some unintended consequences.
And when you think of, just kind of as we, you know, maybe wrap up here in a little bit, but like, as you think of, you know, I know you've written a whole book on, you know, Do I Stay Christian? Subtitle is A Guide for the Doubters, the Disappointed, and the Delusion. What are kind of the reasons that you still, if you still claim Christianity, what are kind of the big reasons? Yes. Like, why do you stay Christian?
Yes. Well, you know, the 10 chapters I wrote about in the book are certainly relevant for me. Maybe I'll just mention a couple of them. One is because leaving hurts allies and helps their opponents. If I'm discouraged because in the Christian religion, there's a resurgence of white Christian nationalism, for example, a kind of racist form of Christianity. Meanwhile, there are amazing Black and Brown and Asian and Indigenous Christians who are helping renew the faith by bringing in diverse perspectives. In a sense, if I leave, I hurt the people I would like to help, and I help the people who I don't want to help.
Yeah.
So it's this sense that I have a responsibility to try to make something that I've been part of to make it better. Another chapter is because leaving defiantly and staying compliantly are not my only options. So I talk about the option of staying to be a change maker in the Christian faith. Another chapter, because it would be a shame to leave a religion in its infancy. And that relates to another chapter, because Christianity is changing. And so if I can understand that the problems I see in the Christian faith are problems that are going to get worse in some quarters, but if I invest myself, maybe can get better in some quarters too. I have a couple chapters where I talk about innocence, the idea that if something embarrasses me or I think is wrong and I just reject it and separate myself from it, that has unintended consequences for me and for the world. And I felt really good about those chapters. You know, one of the key chapters was, as you mentioned before, because of our legendary founder. And I think there is a way for me to stay and deepen my loyalty and commitment to Jesus that helps me stay in the Christian faith and helps me to relate lovingly to people of other faiths. And that is probably the most important reason for me.
Well, yeah, thank you so much, Brian McLaren, for taking some time to meet with me and talk with me. And I love the book, and I've loved all your books, and I continue to pass them to my friends. And it's really great to meet you, and hopefully we'll keep the conversation going.
My heart is with you.
Thanks for listening to this show today, everybody. I just want to give a few shout outs. Today's music, the one and only Josh Cleveland. Today's artwork and all the Winter Faith artwork and digital design, Dominique Montaigne. The intro was done by Scarlett Fox. And I am just grateful to be creating and editing this podcast. My name is Andy Frazier. Find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at The Winter Faith Podcast. Subscribe on all those platforms, and also we are on Patreon if you would like to support the show, and also leave a review on iTunes at The Winter Faith Podcast. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next week.